Hello, what's up, what's up? Welcome to a bonus episode of the One Inch Barrier. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ojano, and I hope you're all staying safe and staying healthy. And I don't know, so at the time of recording, I'm still staying at home. I hope you're all taking care of each other, of yourselves and each other. As at the time of recording, there is this thing called Delta. I don't know if you heard that, so just let's take care of one another. Bonus episodes are available in full on Patreon, so be sure to check that out. We've already finished the retrospective on 2019 and 18 nominees for foreign language film, aside from the winners. There's some exciting stuff next season, and this episode is exciting because this is the first bonus episode that I'm doing off season. I am in between regular seasons, and next season's gonna be a lot, so I just want to get something out in between before I subject myself to that. Anyway, that whole thing, which I'm looking forward to. It's both pleasure and pain for me, but I love this podcast. So anyway, so I'm excited because in these like off-season bonus episodes, I get to freely choose the film that I'm going to talk about. And for this episode, we're going to talk about something that I've been wanting to talk about since last year. It's Portrait of a Lady in Fire, or in its original language, Portrait de la Jeune Fille en Feu, written and directed by Céline Sciamma. This film is about a painter named Marianne, who was tasked to paint the mother, the daughter of a countess. The daughter is Eloise. She is to be married off to a man that she hasn't even met yet. So they have to paint a portrait of her so that they would send a portrait to the man. And then if the man agrees, they would send Eloise and then they would get married. So Marianne masquerades herself as a walking company. I don't know the right word. So they had this kind of distant bond that becomes close and close as the time went on, until, you know, Marianne is revealed to be painting Eloise, and where that relationship takes off. That is a quick summary of Portrait of a Lady in Fire. Unscripted, it's coming from the heart. All right, so for this episode, our guest is from the United States. Our guest is a filmmaker and a co-host of the Untitled Cinema Gals Project and Community Rewatch podcasts. And it must be known that she's an Audrey Hepburn historian and Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again enthusiast. And I'm so happy to have a conversation with her after quite a long time. Please welcome Chelsea Eichels. Hi, Chels. Thank you so much for joining me for this film.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. I feel like my life has been leading up to this. Oh my goodness. That was a beautiful introduction of all my silly facts.
Yes. Oh, well, those were wonderful facts. I'm excited because the last time we spoke, I've mentioned this in our before we recorded, we were both guests in End Runner Up Is, Cover Sense and Sensibility. That was a wonderful first time, even though I was half awake, and that was a wonderful time that we have recorded. And I've been like trying to find a film to talk with you, but I just like, you know, like floating in my mind. And then when the opportunity arose, and I'm like, I'm just gonna go for it and reach out to her after more than a year already. It's fast. Staying at home is fast. And that's why I'm just excited to discuss this with you. Can you tell our listeners where can they find you on the internet?
I am Chels725 on Twitter. It's also me on Letterboxd. And then I do a lot of stuff with the Untitled Cinema Gals Project. You'll eventually be a guest once we schedule things, because we just make things up as we go. And we have a lot of film fun there. And then if you guys like TV, I have the Community Rewatch podcast. If you like the TV show Community, I edit over there, sometimes co-host. This summer, we're covering the TV show Mythic Quest. And we have a bunch of different bonus episodes of other TV shows that people like Schitt's Creek. So I keep busy.
There you go. I would just like to give a shout out to a guest in a regular episode, 1972, J.M. Hamisola. He's been itching when we were working together in 2017, he's been itching for me to start watching Community. But then I was like, listen, this is my first year watching TV. I'm going to take things slow. And I just binged 5 seasons of House of Cards. I don't think that was a wise investment at the time. But I'm looking forward for more TV. And I've heard wonderful things about Community. And Mythic Quest is getting some wonderful buzz, especially this Emmy season. And yeah, the person in me loves TV as much as I love film. And I would not have said that before 2017, but here we are. And I'm so excited to have you here because we both love film and TV. And yeah, we're just full of love. So we're going to talk now about this film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. You were kind of excited when I mentioned the idea.
I'm so excited.
What was happening? I mean, what is your relationship with this film?
So I heard good things whenever it came out of Cannes Film Festival that year. And then I got to go see it at the St. Louis International Film Festival. I remember because it was the night of a blizzard. So I say I fought a blizzard to see Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And I was absolutely mesmerized. And then whenever they dropped it on like Valentine's Day in theaters here again, I watched it in theaters again. And I also had my Film Independence Spirit Award screeners, and I would just put the screener on in the background while I was working. So I feel like I've seen the movie, or it's just lived with me so much. I bought the Criterion like the day it came out. So I am like a stan, I guess you would say. I don't usually use the word, but yeah, I love this film so much. There's just something beautiful about the silent moments in it and just how the relationship comes together. And it's just, it never gets old, or it hasn't yet.
Yeah. I have some thoughts, but I'm just going to shut myself up for now. You said that, you know, it's, I guess you're part of the Portrait Nation. I don't know if they call it that. I forgot.
I don't know. I feel like I just love my things quietly and then talk to it with a couple friends. I imagine there's great stands out there that are actually doing the work to promote the film. Not me. I'm just loving things in silence.
Yeah, I would have, if I had the art skills, I would have like designed tattoos and painting, but not me. I'm just like a humble podcaster. So you rewatch this, what made you, do you have and like in the multiple rewatches now that you've had, what do you think, aside from the silences, or maybe you can expound on that, what is it about this film that made you fall in love with it?
Almost the simplicity of it, because I know there's a lot of lesbian period piece dramas with and without electricity, and some people love Carol. I love Carol usually more visually than like loving the characters themselves. But this one, I felt like I actually knew the characters really well from the little time I had with them, and that they told a very full and complete story and it had a satisfying ending. I don't want to spoil the ending just yet, but I don't know. It just all came together in a perfect way. They had like beautiful conflict, but it never felt fake or staged. And the lack of a male gaze throughout the whole thing, even with male characters, how often has that ever happened? Even in Carol, you have to deal with the men figures. They're like the big conflict powering over this couple. And that just doesn't feel the same here. It's just like their time is the conflict.
Yeah, I mean, you've already touched on that, the concept of the female gaze in this film. And I don't think I'm fully capable of expounding on that. Maybe you would want to expound on that later. But for me, what is this about the concept of the female gaze is that it's so fascinating because it's intrinsically embedded in the story. It's about painting. It's about someone observing. So the gaze isn't just something that you see on the text, like on the shots or something, but it is embedded in a story. So I love it when we see content or films where the way it's being told is embodied in the actual story. So there is this unity, there's this completeness that you feel because everything's just lining up with one another. Like, you know, this is about a female gaze, and then it's also done with the female gaze, and then the story is all about that as well. For me, I always go back to the word intense. I don't know why. When I watch the film, it's really quiet. Except when it's not. The sound, even the sound design, it's not something that one would think of like sound design of the year. But there is so much precision in how sound plays a role in how scenes unfold. And I think it's just intensely beautiful. And I don't mean it in just like, technically speaking, I mean, it is. I mean, the cinematography by Clermont-Tonnerre is just like, whew, wow. But there is so much beauty in how it trusts the smallest of moments between characters to deliver a fully formed story, which is satisfying on multiple levels. And it's exciting because this film makes you look closer because it's in the details where it really thrives. And those just excite me. I am so excited when I watch this film. I mean, I might not be in the nation, the Portrait Nation, but gosh, I think very highly of this. Like, this is the kind of film that people should study in, like, if they want to make films, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of like specificity. And like, I'm jealous as a filmmaker. Like, I'm jealous Celine, you did this. I'm jealous.
I agree with pretty much everything you said. It's just, again, the cinematography, it blows me away, but I love how you touched on the sound of the film because there's not a lot of like score in it, and whenever sound is used, it's very purposeful because it's very meaningful to one of the characters and how she has only heard music from like the convent. And whenever you do hear music, it's just like you feel it that much more because you haven't had it. And then just the sounds of like the women on the island and like every little touch, and how like when you hear something, it's usually like shaking you out of a moment where you think a character is alone because somebody's like sneaking up or coming in or knocking on a door. And it just, everything felt like a very intimate setting, and it just draws me in every time. It's just like this weird magic. It gets me every single time.
Exactly. And it's like, it's intimate, but it's also, you know, respectful of the characters. It's not intrusive, like intimacy or anything. It's really, having that space, the perfectly measured space between us, the observer, and what we see on screen. And, you know, when the first time I saw it, I'm like, all right, these waves are loud. Or like these winds are like out of control. But then on a second watch, I realized, oh no, that's deliberate. Oh, the way that, you know, when we first see Marianne and when they go on walks, and how there is this crashing of waves and wind while we are on the edge of our seat waiting to see how this relationship will unfold or unravel or whatever, that intensity with it's about maximizing what we have. You know, we don't have score. The cinematography, in as much as it's beautiful, like, gosh, it's unbelievable the way those colors just like pop out of the screen. It's not something that one would easily call like a technical achievement, which we usually see in like the best cinematography category. Oh, the one takes of it all. Like, oh, the...
Oh, yeah. It's like all of those like big technical, I'm going to call it the Roger Deakins and like the Birdmans recently.
I wasn't dropping names, but let's go.
I'll drop names. So many of those feats of cinematography are actually feats of your visual effects team and your editing team stringing together these like very long takes. And whenever I look at cinematography, I'm like, okay, like Nomadland, for instance, is a good one. Do all of these sunsets match? Because all of these characters, you only have so much time to get this very specific lighting. Are you able to capture all of this, make it seamless? How are, like, people forget light is part of cinematography. So whenever I see something that's so beautifully lit, like Portrait of a Lady on Fire, where there's obviously mirror work, and candles being used very carefully to light sources, I'm like, that is so much smarter to me than you just giving footage to your editor of 1917 and making day for night. That's the editor doing the job, not the cinematographer. I mean, shots fired, I guess.
I love it. And also, I think, you know, we naturally veered into cinematography because, you know, this film is a thing of beauty. And I think we start with what we have, what we see. But, you know, we get to dig deeper as our conversation goes on. But, you know, I think the conversation that, you know, cinephiles usually have with cinematography is sort of like, how is it difficult to pull something off? I think we some are starting to forget that It's really not just a technical. I mean, it is. We can appreciate the tough long takes, but I also want to say that sometimes, you know, sometimes things get lost when we get busy in technical stuff, and we have to remind ourselves, like, what is best cinematography actually? I'm not even like going to awards yet, but like, what is a great cinematography? Is it something that, oh, it's tough to pull off, or is it something that sucks me into the story and makes me feel emotions through the visual language that the film establishes? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Some of these long take things that we've talked about, so much of the details get lost. And Portrait of a Lady on Fire is a film all about details. It's the little things in the corner, the little cutaways later that you'll take, or the close up of her trying to hide her hands because there's paint on them, and how she slowly moves it from behind her to in front of her in a very small part of the scene where they're just casually having conversation. So again, I hope Portrait of a Lady on Fire is one of those films I hope people watch, especially if they want to be a cinematographer, and help them rethink what cinematography can be.
Definitely. It's from the technical to, I mean, directors, future directors, I implore you to watch. I mean, I wish I'd seen this in film school because, you know, with the completeness of Sidney Siyama's vision, like you said, you know, when we mention detail, it crosses so many like aspects of it. You know, it's not just where the camera points at this moment, but it's like, the pauses are so precise. Those pauses between movements, the way the Noemi Melon and Adeline Neal, who's looking at who, who's flinching their eye. Those small moments and the way they're blocked and within scenes, within shots, how the movement is paced and how they all bring something to the story. And that's, we're not even talking about the words yet, because the words are kind of like few and far in between. But like, again, kind of like in editing, in cinematography, screenplay isn't just like the most words. Here, every word means something. Mm-hmm. And that's another beauty of this film.
Yeah, you got to it earlier. Everything is super intentional. And every movement forward story, every facial movement, the raise of the eyebrow, the biting of a lip, it like they all have meaning. So everyone be like director Bong, who loves this film and loves this director as much as I do.
Yeah. And I'm excited to go back because I think I've only seen like a few of Sidney Siyama's works. I've seen Tomboy, I've seen Girlhood, and this one. I have friends who are like recommending me. Sidney Siyama did Water Lilies.
Pardon?
Did she do Water Lilies?
Yes.
Oh yeah. So definitely, yeah. They're recommending me watch Water Lilies. I'm like, okay, sure.
And all of because her like, films are beautiful and intentional, and I feel like they were all leading up to this. And I'm very excited for her new film. That's very short. Again, she makes some very nice short watchable movies. And so, yes, I'm looking forward to that new one she has.
Yeah, this one feels like a consummation of not just, I mean, I don't know her personally, but just like an artist's work. It's so, everything just came together. And, you know, I mean, obviously the costumes are like, you know, I mean, again, costume design usually goes to like with the most costumes or the most crowds being dressed. But with this one, again, it's part of the visual beauty of it where the dresses also matter, and they matter so much in the color and the cuts and how they indicate where we are in the characters. It's really beautifully also done. And oh, as someone who loves editing, I'm saying that this film is not someone that most people would look at for like editing, but gosh, it's again precise.
It's patient. So precise. It doesn't waste a moment. They're not trying to go out of their way to impress you with 20 different storylines. I'm like, again, that doesn't impress me. Telling a full coherent timeline of a story impresses me. So if I'm wondering why did this thing happen earlier in the film, I'm gonna be like, well, that was a weird editing choice. They could have moved it forward, or they could have rearranged something. This, I feel like I never questioned why things happened that way. And one thing people don't realize is screenwriting and editing go hand in hand. I joke every great screenwriter is actually a really good editor, because you're mentally editing as you write. And you have to remember, screenplays aren't these beautiful poetic works where you're doing flowery language. It is a blueprint of how to make the film. And then you bring in your production designer and your director and your cinematographer. And then they bring that blueprint to life. It's like an architect. So I'm always, again, anytime I see screenwriting and editing, I'm like, ooh, I feel like that is a really good relationship, because you're literally handing off something to one person and making it work. And this is just seamless.
Definitely. And, you know, I mean, I might be stealing some things from Lessons from the Screenplay, who did a wonderful essay in this one on the relationship of, and I think it's screenplay, but you know, as someone who writes screenplays with an editor's mind already, you don't really get these very precise moments, especially with this film, because this film doesn't give it an easy time to itself. Because, you know, when we have, for example, when we have a scene and there's a problem with how it's staged, well, let's just cut here and there so that we could piece it together and make it better and like make it feel better. But this one, the film doesn't make easy choices, and the editing, it can lengthen a shot and you're just like, wait, this isn't just not going anywhere. This is going somewhere. And then sometimes when someone is going to respond to a conversation, then we cut sharply to something abruptly different, like, I don't know, the sea. It's so, it excites me, you know, as an editor to see how, as an editor, my gosh, it excites me to see how skillful it is when you least expect it. But again, it goes back to just how everything is well thought of, and there is this flow that doesn't just make the story captivating, but gives the romance the life it needs for it to breathe and for us to be in that same space.
And it's like not just emotionally. How people are always like, there's a lot of editing, there's a lot of quick edits. They give this so much room to breathe. It's not afraid of the long take and letting a scene play out. And that's just the sign of a good editor, because they could have multiple options and being able to cut between the people talking. Or they can just let us observe the people and in that moment. And sometimes edits, like the sharp cuts, take you out of the moment because you kind of wish you could see both characters and the reactions. And again, this is just the sign of a very precise director, writer, working with the cinematographer and the editor, and everything coming together in a way that really just makes a very watchable, good movie. I'm just like gushing about this film. I feel like I'm just so impressed.
I am as well. I'm like, it's 4.5 with me Letterboxd, and I'm gushing. So like, even if I'm not the 5 out of 5 person that maybe you are, there's so much. I mean, an episode like this, in as much as we'll try our best to, like, you know, I mean, but I think this is a kind of film which writers write a book about.
Mm-hmm.
That study and pick apart, study scene by scene, shot by shot.
Because it's definitely one of those movies loaded. Where I would want a making of book, because they do that for so many movies or plays or something, and you almost kind of don't care. It's like, I don't care how they made whatever this film is. But this one, I'm like, okay, I'm actually very curious in my film school way of wanting to know how things were done, just to like show friends. Because that's just so much more impressive. And release all the bonus features behind the scenes, everyone.
Yeah, I mean, there are films that we love, and we're like, but I don't need to know how they made it. But with this one, I want to see how. I want to see director's notes. I want to see academics' take on it. I want to see an editor. I want to see Claire Maton's like notes from Celine and their exchange. I want to see their text. No one leaking it, okay? But I want to see their
text. Yeah, you definitely want to see like the storyboards, like how they did the Parasite storyboard book, which is beautiful. I got to see one. I have not bought it because it was very expensive, the one I saw.
Oh my gosh.
So expensive. But I'm like, I would very much like something like that with little notes and storyboard if they did it, or like just whatever they were doing. Almost like, so I have, back to Sense and Sensibility, I have Emma Thompson's like journal screenplay thing she did. Oh, I'll show it to you after pod. It's beautiful. But it has like all the fun little notes about her writing it and making the film. And it's just, again, it's one of those films that's like, oh, you can learn so much from this.
Yeah. And even for me, even just like getting a hand of the script and watching it side by side with the film, that would enthrall me to see. Because even in writing, like, you know, we're both filmmakers, and you gotta get the writing right.
Because that's where it's all gonna come from. If there's problems in your script and you're already filming, I worry so much. And you hear about that with so many films. I'm just gonna name drop The Revenant. I know they had every production problem in the world because they wanted to use natural light. And it went over budget. And I think that's why it never won Best Pictures, because the actual production part of it was a nightmare that was well recorded.
Yeah.
But it's like, y'all, you just got to be so precise in everything you're planning. And especially as a woman filmmaker, she has less opportunity to fail. Yeah. So you have to be better.
Yeah.
It's like Jordan Peele also. He had a very small budget to make it out. And that is a very precise, beautifully edited and shot film where everything leans into each other. And I'm like, he had way less opportunity to win in that instance, because he was given hardly any money to make something. And then he just like exceeded and blew everyone's mind. And that's why he's getting all these wonderful opportunities now, because he had to prove people wrong. Which sucks, because you get all these other white filmmakers who fail all the time and they're given 20,000 chances.
Hey, what's up? Thank you for listening to this preview of this bonus episode. If you want to hear more, please head to patreon.com/theoneinchbarrier. For only $4 a month, not only do you have full access to bonus episodes, but you also get early access to regular episodes. Again, thank you so much, and together, let's break the 1-inch barrier.